We'll have a relatively short meeting, I think, today, going over some technical issues with our look at these tax credits and incentives. It looks like House Bill 2066 will likely be the vehicle that we will eventually vote on down the road here. So I think maybe we should start off with that and open up a hearing on the underlying bill. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2066 and go to Chris Allenay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What's in 2066 currently is a technical fix. It just changes the definition of logger to conform with the industry standards. Apparently, loggers are no longer paid on a per-unit cut basis. This is one of the technical issues that we've had on the list for a few sessions, and it's kind of always fallen through the cracks. But that's what's before you right now. And I think it comes from the Department of Revenue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's called up by the department.
Mm. So, Rep. Barnard. Thank you. So they used to be paid on piecework, and now they're not anymore.
In a nutshell, yes. That's okay. My understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lois Williams with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I just want to reiterate exactly what Chris said. This is an area that was brought to our attention a couple of years ago, in that certain types of logging occupations that have to travel greater than 50 miles are allowed this subtraction. It's not a credit, but it's a subtraction on the personal income tax return. It was put in place back in the 70s to put them on an even par with construction workers who also had to travel over 50 miles to a location. At that time, people were paid either in wages or they were paid on a per unit cut basis. But over the years, we're not aware of now any employees who are paid that way. If they are paid on a per-unit basis, it's usually because they are an independent contractor, a small business person. And, of course, they're able to deduct those types of expenses as a business expense. So here we have this allowance for a logging subtraction, but to our knowledge, no one is able to use it. We did do some research. About a year and a half ago, we reached out to six different variety of logging companies, and we just point-blank asked them how they paid and what their experience in the industry was, and they indicated that, no, if we have an employee, they're paid wages. If it's an independent contractor, they're more likely to be paid on a per-unit basis, but not as an employee. So we are bringing this issue forward for you to make a decision as to how you would like to modify, if you want to, this particular subtraction.
Questions of the department?
Maybe of Chris.
Yes, Rep. Barnhart.
Thank you. What's the revenue implication, if any?
I'm not aware of any revenue implication.
Thank you.
This has no fiscal, no revenue impact.
That's correct. To our knowledge, we're not aware of anyone claiming the credit and or eligible to or the subtraction or eligible to claim the subtraction at this time, the way the law is currently written.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, thank you. With the change, then one presumes people might become eligible. Mm-hmm. And that would be what our revenue impact would be.
Co-Chair Barnhart, that's correct, but we do not know how many people would be claiming it at this point.
Okay. I'll look into that a little bit more.
Rep. Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the most respectful way, so why are we doing it? Ben, if no one claims it that we're aware of and there's not a call for it?
Co-chairs and Representative Smith Warner, that's the position of the department, is we're bringing it forward to let you know that there is a statute on the books that we feel is outdated and that may need your attention.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Right.
Just
to inquire further, thank you. As I'm reading this, it looks like the old rule basically allowed a logger who worked on a piecework basis to deduct daily transportation expenses that aren't deductible under the Internal Revenue Code, which I suppose means traveling from home to where he picks up the truck. And then it goes on to define what those are. So this is a special deal for loggers who might travel quite some distance to get to the place where they go to work. There so it is a policy question.
There was a hearing in the House Revenue Committee on the 31st of May,
mm-hmm.
where their forest product people are represented.
OFIC, he's there.
OFIC, that perhaps you're not signed up. You could weigh in on this. We'll let this go for a while and let it breathe, and maybe we'll get some comments as time marches on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis. We'll close public hearing on 2066 and open up a public hearing on House Bills 2075 and Senate Bill 171. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these two bills deal with the credit for fire insurance premium tax. In OLIS, under meeting materials, I have a document. It's entitled Tax Credit Summaries. The committee will be dealing with three different tax credits. This document is more or less three or four pages, and it just highlights effectively what each of the tax credits is. So what this credit is, insurance companies that pay the insurance gross premium tax are allowed a credit of that tax amount against their corporate income tax. And so that's just a one-for-one tax credit. In that document, I have additional information. The cost of the tax credit, there's a graph there that shows the amount claimed and the amount used. And for the most part, in recent years, the amount claimed has been around $9 million. It's gone up to $10 million. And the amount used has been $4 million. So there's a fair amount of tax credit that gets unused. The impact, however, gets a little complicated because it touches on the retaliatory tax. So while the tax credit costs the general fund from the excise tax about $4 million, there's an interaction with the retaliatory tax. And so either letting it repeal or keeping it in place affects those collections so that the overall cost of extending the tax credit isn't the $4 million a year. It's about $1.2 million a year. And in an effort to try and explain how that interaction works, there is an example. So I thought I'd just walk through that. So for this example, we have two similar insurance companies, one domestic, one foreign, by foreign, not Oregon. And the bottom line is that they have a fire insurance premium tax of $15,000. So we have here the Oregon insurer. So we have taxes and fees, et cetera, the total amount of taxes and fees, licenses, without the tax credit for the Oregon insurer and the non-Oregon insurer. So for the Oregon insurer, in the state of Oregon, their tax, their total taxes and so forth is $1,125,000. And for the non-Oregon insurer, it's the same amount. I've set them up to try and simplify this as much as possible. So their state of Oregon tax liability is $1.125 million. They also operate in the state of not Oregon, and their liability there is $1.2 million. So the Oregon's retaliatory tax is imposed on the not Oregon insurer. And because Oregon charges their insurers the $1.125 million, and the other state charges $1.2 million, the retaliatory tax is the $75,000 to bring them up to parity. That's the whole point of the retaliatory tax. Basically saying, Oregon says, that if the other state charges our insurers more than we charge theirs, the retaliatory tax is the difference. So in this case, Oregon is charging their tax, their insurer, $1.125 million. They're charging ours $1.2 million. So then we're going to impose a $75,000 retaliatory tax.
To make them even.
So the relevant piece with the tax credit bill you have before you is now we go to the next block where it's taxes and fees, etc., with the tax credit. So for both of these companies, the state of Oregon, now the liability goes from $1.125 million to $1.11 million. There's the $15,000 tax credit because each of these insurers pays the $15,000 fire insurance premium tax. They get the credit against their Oregon tax. So their Oregon tax goes from $1,125,000 to $1,110,000. The tax liability in the other state stays the same. It is unaffected. It's $1.2 million. And so for the Oregon insurer, their tax liability with the credit falls by the $15,000. For the not Oregon insurer, however, the retaliatory tax offsets that tax credit. So they get the credit of $15,000, so their tax goes to $1,110,000, but the retaliatory tax evens them out again, so the retaliatory tax goes up by the $15,000, because the goal there is whatever the other state charges. It's really an equalizing, if that's the proper term, an equalizing measure for the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the interaction. Mm-hmm. So that's, and obviously, gets a lot more complicated, but that's why there's not this one-to-one trade-off for eliminating the tax credit because of this interaction. And the retaliatory taxes do go into the general fund. Those are the big chunk of the insurance taxes that go into the general fund. So it's just moving money around for the within the general fund. But depending on the taxpayer and the taxpayer situation, there may not always be a one-to-one offset. So I'm not sure if any examples on this tax actually help. But here's another attempt.
We were too polite to say that out loud.
Wow. Okay.
Cubicles all day long.
All right.
Jeez.
I shudder to ask this question in public and expose my ignorance. So why do we renew this and examine it every 6 years? It seems like it's something peculiar that we're sort of doing to fix something. It doesn't seem like it's a tax credit per se, I guess, in the normal sense of the way that I think of them. So why are we, because something might change 3 years from now and this strange scheme will no longer be necessary?
Rep Nos, it's a good question, and it highlights how the functions of the tax credits vary. Some of them are definitely intended that there's a purpose. Well, let me take a step back. So the legislature passes a tax credit with a purpose in mind, and if that purpose is to increase employment or increase investment, there can be a day where that's no longer needed. The purpose has been achieved. And that's kind of the traditional tax credit people think of. But this is one of the tax credits where if it's just a kind of funding mechanism, if you will, then the purpose may be achieved. So then it's possible that the sunset be repealed, but that's entirely a policy call. Some people are more comfortable with having the sunset, so it does come before the legislature, because the members of the legislature churn over time, so there's always different perspectives.
So we can have this same conversation 6 years from now if I'm so lucky enough to be doing this that long.
So I get to go through these examples.
A new set of confused faces.
Rep Barnhart.
Thank you. It is long enough since we dealt with this that I've forgotten the answer to this question.
I don't know why.
Why do we need this tax credit at all?
That was my
What's
exactly.
the point of it?
Chair Barnhart, that also is a policy call. The tax credit, there is a different treatment between Oregon insurers and not Oregon insurers, foreign insurers. So there is that incidence of the tax credit.
Because it's funding for the office.
It gets even more complicated when you talk about the retaliatory taxes imposed by other states on Oregon insurers. Across the states, there's a balancing. This retaliatory tax, there's a balancing among the taxpayers throughout the states. But it doesn't fund directly the fire marshal's office, which is the fire insurance premium tax does that.
Yeah.
But this offsets the taxpayers. It offsets a little bit of that tax.
Nice. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, we do have some people signed up to
weigh
in on this. So let's get the start. Let's start with the Oregon State Fire Marshal, Jim Walker, and Eric Gablitz from DPSSTPSSD.
Nice. You made that into a palindrome. That was good, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. For the record, Eric Skablich from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. What State Fire Marshal Walker and I want to do is kind of talk about what the tax does, and then John Powell kind of explain how it works from the insurance perspective. The state of Oregon has had a relationship with the insurance industry for decades, and the tax, as you just heard, funds three very important programs for the state of Oregon that are other funded, and that includes the Office of State Fire Marshal that Jim's going to talk about, Oregon State Police Arson Explosives Unit, and then the Department of Public Safety Training and Certification section with our agency. So collectively, we are serving 13,000 firefighters across the state with these funds, 80% of which are volunteer. So for DPSST, that allows us to provide training across the state free of charge to the men and women doing this work. It also allows us to have a professional certification system. And if you wonder why the insurance industry is important or interested in that, because they have the same interest that Oregonians do to make sure firefighters are trained and prepared to respond to emergencies and deal with them effectively. So the partnership's been there for years, and we just want to give you kind of some insight. And I think Jim will give you more about how much revenue comes in and what we do with it.
And Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, committee members, for the record, Jim Walker, Oregon State Fire Marshal. Most of you that were here, I think Representative Barnhart, you were here when we went before you folks about 6 years ago to get an increase in the fire insurance premium tax. At that time, it was 1%, and we had an awful lot of support from the insurance industry to do that. And so there is an incentive for this tax to be applied and for us to receive those funds. It's currently 1.15, of which we receive about $25 million, and that $25 million funds, again, DPSST, our Oregon State Police arson detectives, and then two of our really key programs. One of those, our Fire and Life Safety Program, which is our deputies that are spread out across the state that do code enforcements on schools, hospitals, vulnerable population areas. They also do fire investigations. And then our prevention programs. And our prevention programs are really those ones that are putting out those messages to try to eliminate, you know, fire fatalities as well as fire damage. And that's that real strong relationship with the insurance industry. We actually started within the insurance industry and then have moved around over the last 100 years. So we are actually celebrating our 100th year anniversary, June 20th, and you're all invited if you want to come. But because of that relationship, we really focus on those things that do limit the impact to citizens and to communities. We've also used it for over the last 3 years when we've had significant fires in the state of Oregon. We've used the fire insurance premium tax to fund those responses rather than come before the Ways and Means and request general fund dollars. Only once in the last probably 10 years have we done that, and that was 3 years ago when we were about $8.8 million. We have about a $500,000 budget for wildland fires, urban interface fires, and so we've been utilizing it for that as well. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
On your 100th birthday, will you have 100 candles on that cake, and how will you manage that situation?
Chair Haas, they'll be those new battery-powered ones.
Okay, yeah. So. Okay, you guys are no fun. Any questions of this panel on fire insurance? Senator Taylor?
Very important.
Okay. Rep. Barnhart?
Thank you. The tax you keep referring to, that's the premium tax?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
John Powell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. I represent State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. Before you today in support of these two bills before you. This is a difficult discussion to have simply because every time I come before the committee, it changes based on some assumptions that different people have made as you open the committee. So what I'd like to do is to attempt to create a common foundation for the discussion if I can, and I might not be able to, but I will try. The for example, premium tax was mentioned, and Oregon does not have an insurance premium tax. We have a fire insurance premium tax, but most states have a premium tax. For example, State Farm's domicile state is Illinois. They have a 2% premium tax. If an Oregon company sells a fire insurance policy in Illinois, they give the state of Illinois 2% of that premium as a tax. So when State Farm comes to Oregon and writes an insurance policy, they give the state of Oregon 2% of that tax, even though we don't have a premium tax because of the retaliatory tax. Oregon says, we're going to tax you the same as you tax our domicile companies. So that pillar of this foundation, I think, can be summarized in the fact that insurance companies pay the state of Oregon a lot of taxes. A lot of taxes have nothing to do with the fire insurance premium tax. It's probably the third or fourth largest single entity of infusion into the general fund, because it turns out being a lot of money based on all the foreign insurers, foreign meaning not domiciled in Oregon. It's a lot of money. Domestic companies will pay through the corporate income tax, as well as other insurance companies will also end up filing a corporate tax as well. But domestic companies pay that. And the reason that this happened was back in the 1990s, Oregon treated its domiciled companies different than foreign companies in taxation. Those foreign companies, not the ones I represent, but some of them, threatened to sue the state of Oregon over the inequity. So Governor Kitzhaber at the time believed that rather than most health insurance in Oregon was written by domestic companies. And rather than adding that 2.25% at the time premium onto the health insurance premiums, that Oregon would go to a zero premium tax and basically rely on the retaliatory tax and the corporate income tax for domestics. And that's the way the law is today. So I think the first pillar of understanding is insurance pays a lot of taxes in Oregon and to the state of Oregon. The fire insurance premium tax is a very, very small part of that overall tax policy. And as was mentioned before by the fire marshal, at one point in time, the insurance industry funded the fire marshal by itself without going through a tax system. It just paid for it outright. And some, they got together and decided who would pay how much and that sort of thing. And over the years, as the fire marshal's office expanded and took on other responsibilities and took fees for other services and that sort of thing, it was determined that the best way to fund it would, again, have the insurance companies put up the money through this tax and as an incentive to go along with this program to have a tax credit. And as you can see, it's a relatively small tax credit. And it's probably the size of it and the importance of this agency's continued existence over time is probably why the governor put this in her budget. So this is one of the few tax credits that's actually in the governor's budget. These types of taxes are historical. Every state does them a little differently. There will be states, and you may hear testimony, other states do it differently. In some states, the insurance company adds on a surcharge onto each policy, gathers that money in through a direct assessment against each customer, and that goes to the fire marshal. In Oregon, it's just assessed directly against the insurance company, and the insurance company does not have a surcharge blank on your insurance policy to pay for this. So it is a tax against the insurance company, but it could be done in all those different ways. In some states, businesses pay a fee. And it's all fee-funded through assessments against businesses. So it's historical in the way it's set up. We think it works, and it works well, except for my explanation of how it works. So Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to try to answer any questions.
Thanks for walking us through there. Questions, John Powell, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say I found Mr. Powell's explanation more helpful than Chris's example.
He did a good job.
Thank you. I know we went through this 6 years ago, and I knew that I thought I understood it then. Yeah. I still am having a difficult time understanding what this credit is for. Normally, a tax credit is designed to encourage some activity that we'd like to encourage. I'm not sure we need to encourage people to buy fire insurance, since there are a lot of other reasons to buy fire insurance other than this tax credit. And it appears to be a mechanism to transfer some money from the general fund into the support of the fire marshal's office. Through this kind of peculiar mechanism. What am I missing?
Mr. Chairman and Co-Chair Barnhart, I don't think you're missing anything. I think the deal is getting about $25 million infused to run an agency in exchange for about $1.2 million in tax credit. And I think it was, at the time, historically, it's been an incentive to participate in that and leave the old system, which was basically the jurisdiction of the industry and not government. So I think it was an incentive to continue in that system and contributing by taxation as opposed to a voluntary assessment.
Answer your question?
I think so. There really is a follow-up, if I may. We're in big trouble on our budget this year. Why should we spend? And I don't think it's $1.2 million. If I read this correctly, it's actually $4 million this year and $8 million in the next biennium. Why should we continue with the old deal, if that's what it is, when we could keep that money in the general fund and use it to pay for schools and health care?
Mr. Chairman and Co-Chair Barnhart, absolutely same question and same policy decision on every single tax credit that's out there. It's the same question. This is designed to fund an agency that does a lot of good things, and it was set up this way, for a relatively small investment, the general fund gets, I think, a great deal of service to the state of Oregon.
So one final thing, and then I'm done. When was this, if you remember, when was this agreement, as it were, promulgated?
I believe it was 1969.
That's what it says up there on the screen.
Oh, it says that in there. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I get that the tax is used to fund the fire marshal and that the tax credit is designed to give the insurance companies the money back that they use to fund the fire marshal. And at some point, I guess in 1969, before that, the insurance companies were just paying the whole thing, and now we sort of took over paying it. Because most of what you put into it with this tax, we give you back. Is that,
Mr.
am
Chair-
I missing, tell me I'm missing
Mr.
something.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, a fraction of it is given back.
Okay. Okay, so it is giving it back. It's just not most of it.
Right.
But it is giving it back to the insurance
giving
companies.
Some of it back.
Yes. That's right. So.
Of 25 million.
Okay. see no reason to do it.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser.
He's going to agree with you.
I know.
Excuse me. Bless you.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So we listened to this conversation 6 years ago and looked at what Chris had written and went, well, how is this done in other states? And it was one of the pieces of the tax credits that he didn't have time to go look at other states. And so one of our researchers, Rachel Say, called. But first she looked around, and she found a rather old article that named 12 states that had the fire insurance premium tax, according to the article. And she succeeded in contacting five of those states. One of them, New Jersey, does not collect that tax. Instead, they are 100% funded by annual fees on businesses only. And the other four all collect the tax. They all believe that the tax was being paid by the ratepayers, not by the insurance companies, and none of them have any tax credit for it. And so it seemed like it doesn't make sense, and it's also hard to understand if you look at the top of the chart that was up earlier. If we are giving out $8 million in tax credits or $10 million in tax credits, why are only half of them being used? Usually tax credits aren't used because there's not the tax liability to use the tax credits with, but you know, there's no way for us to know that. What we got is from talking to that four states, she found that they don't believe the insurance companies pay it. They believe the ratepayers pay it, and that no one else has a tax credit or returns the funds to the insurance companies in any way. So that's the information that we collected. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2075 and Senate Bill 171 and move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 145. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 145 is the Reservation Enterprise Zone Tax Credit. Taxpayers operating a business in a reservation enterprise zone or partnership zone can claim a tax credit equal to the amount of tribal property taxes paid. In that summary document, and it includes some other information. For example, the policy purpose, as stated in statute, is to remove the tax disincentives that currently inhibit private business and industry from locating and operating these enterprises. That's from statute. I'm just reading there. In terms of claimants, roughly 15 taxpayers claim about $15,000 in tax credits a year, and they're able to use about half of that. So there's minimal use in the tax credit. So the cost of extending it would be less than $50,000 per year.
Bill Donovan and Michael Mason, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. First off, we'd want to thank the legislative members of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services for introducing Senate Bill 145. You'll note that this is a repeal of the tax credit as opposed to another six-year extension. That legislation was also brought forward by LRO. But we appreciate that the Senate Revenue Committee moved Senate Bill 145 unanimously to this committee for your consideration today. I've submitted written testimony that you can review at your convenience, but let me just quickly put into context what this tax credit does. If you're in your car, you're driving out I-84, you get through Pendleton, you go about 5 more miles down the road, and there's the Mission exit. You're at that point on the reservation of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla. And at that interchange, the tribes have acquired all four corners of that and have developed services and have created Coyote Business Park, and that is an enterprise zone. That That business park has a mixture of tribally owned and non-tribal businesses located there. And part of the reason why we're able to attract some of those businesses is non-tribally owned businesses is because we're able to tell them you're not going to get double taxed. You're not going to show up here and then have to pay taxes to the tribes to do business here, and then you're going to turn around and have to pay taxes to the state. So it kind of lets them check the box, if you will. They say, hey, we're in an enterprise zone, and there's this tax credit program. As staff laid out to you, it's not a ton of coin, but it's important for us. And, for example, we've been able to bring DaVita Dialysis Center to locate there on the reservation. Previously, people who needed those medical services were trucking over the Blue Mountains to La Grande or having to drive up to the Tri-Cities, and DaVita was able to locate there and provide a medical benefit to the community that we were very excited to have. But we've got other businesses there, including a yoga studio. So with that, that's a quick summary of what it means to us. We would appreciate this committee moving forward. My colleague here had a hand in helping establish this law, so I'll turn to my colleague.
Well, thank you, Phil, and thank you, Chair Haas and Co-Chair Barnhart and members of the Joint Tax Credits Committee. My name for the record is Michael Mason. I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, which is the other tribe that has established a reservation enterprise zone. So far, there are no businesses availing themselves of the tax credit at Warm Springs. This was very significant. It was put forward, as I'm recalling, in 2001, though my memory is getting a little fuzzy back that far, by then Representative Ben Westland, understanding that there was an unemployment problem at the on the Warm Springs Reservation, which has only gotten worse. It's near 50% at this point. And the reason, of course, we're asking for a repeal rather than extension is we have, at this point, effectively an expired tax credit, because you can't attract anybody saying, well, it's they say, well, it's there now, but it's not there January 1st. So in our case particularly, it certainly hasn't achieved the goal yet. So we think it's going to be quite a few years before it does. So we thank you very much for hearing it and for considering this and helping us with trying to attract private investment and partnership on the Warm Springs Reservation. I'm happy to try to answer questions.
So the idea of making this permanent is that it will give more certainty to developers. I mean, 6 years is a long time, too.
Well, in my experience, Chairman, having done a fair bit of tribal economic development work, 6 years isn't very long. People are thinking, they are thinking longer. And when you see, I used to think, well, we have 25-year lease authority. You know, that's what tribes used to have. Well, we now mostly have 50 or 99-year lease authority because people don't feel, businesses don't feel like 25 years is very long. So.
Thank you. I'd like to have Chris to explain how this tax credit actually works and what the sideboards are, if any, other than the sunset.
The tax credit, if to the extent that a tribe imposes a property tax, the amount of property taxes paid by the business would be the tax credit.
So it's a credit on income tax
for
property taxes paid to the tribe. Right, so now I have a question for the witnesses, if I could.
Sure.
Talk about the local tribal property tax a little bit so we can understand how that mechanism works and what the limitations might be on charging businesses property tax, if any.
That's right, and then I'll jump.
Well, I'll say in our case, it's Chair Hess and Co-Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. In our case, that's a little speculative because we don't have a property tax yet at Warm Springs.
Ah.
So we don't have that yet. Just and as I often say, this isn't about the money. It's about attracting the businesses. There's some question whether we would impose the tax, but it's about the certainty for the business. But let me say to that point about the tax equity aspect of it. you know, law enforcement on the Warm Springs is wholly done by the Warm Springs Tribal Police, and they have existed since 1866. It's the longest lived, one of the longest lived tribal police forces in the nation. You know, fire protection is provided and so forth. So the service is there on a reservation that's very unusual in America. They own 99% of the reservation. The tribe does. That's almost unheard of. So, and it's also doesn't have a lot of the state jurisdiction that, say, the West Side reservations have. So it really is up to the tribe and somewhat the federal government. They seem to be shedding their responsibility almost as we speak. But it's pretty much up to the tribe to provide all the basic services and security for any business there.
That would have just been my comment as well, which is we have a modest property tax, which helps fund our fire, police, and water services. You know, we're a checkerboard reservation. Actually, half of our population is non-Indian, and roughly half is Indian, and we provide those services to everybody, regardless of whether they're enrolled or not.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm beginning to understand the process. So if given that the tribe owns pretty much all the land, you don't need a property tax. You just include it in the lease, don't you? The cost of providing these services just would be included in the lease agreement with the tribe, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, Chairman, you could do it that way. Chairman and co-chair, yes. Right. You could do it that way, and that's one reason I say it's not about the money. I mean, this is really about a reassurance to business.
Right. So, but in the case of the other tribe where it's a checkerboard, property tax is probably necessary in order to apply services to that property that you don't own.
And the nice thing about this being a public hearing is that I'll ask my tax administrator on your question about the lease component and can follow up.
All right.
Representative Bugler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair House. So tell me, so tribal land pays county property tax now?
No.
No. Well, Chair Hass and Co-Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, if I could say, in the case of the Umatilla, taxes are paid by approximately 50% of the reservation is not in trust,
right.
Not in federal trust. So those parcels are subject to property tax, state,
county,
you know, local property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. But tribal trust, tribal trust land is not and does not pay county property tax.
That's correct.
So help me explain the rationale why the state of Oregon should provide a tax credit then if
well,
county or state tax.
Well, Chair Hass, Co-Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee, the reason is that the counties provide almost no service. And in the Warm Springs case, the only time that you're going to get any county service, and this is reciprocal, is when tribal police call the sheriff up in Madras and say, we have a serious emergency here. We need help.
Sure.
And that works both ways. I mean, the sheriff will call on tribal police to come off the reservation if it's an overwhelming situation or people are just elsewhere, deputies are elsewhere. So it's basically that, you know, the tribe's providing all the services.
And I would
so would it make sense for the county to tax there?
And I would just chime in, Mr. Co-Chair, that my tax administrator has explained to me ad nauseum that there's a great deal of uncertainty that non-tribal owned businesses feel about doing business on the reservation. And so when they have the ability to look at this and say, okay, we're going to locate in an enterprise zone, they go, that's good, right? We have enterprise zones established all over the state, and businesses like to locate them. And then they say, and what's the tax benefit to that? We say, we have this tax credit. And, you know, quite frankly, it's, as you've seen in the analysis, it's not a lot of money, but we've seen that it's an important tool to be able to assure businesses that are locating that they're going to be treated well.
I mean, how enterprise zones, at least in my concept, works is that, you know, the local government entity or the state has some interest in building that enterprise zone in terms of anticipated future tax revenues. But in this situation, the tax credit is provided, but there is no upside for either the state or county because the entity will never pay taxes on that property. So
the upside is we've been able to attract businesses to rural Oregon. In the case of the Umatilla reservation, our unemployment rates actually mirror that of Umatilla County, which is very unusual amongst reservations across Oregon and the nation.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. And to follow up, is the tax credit infinite? I mean, once granted to a business, there's no period of time in which it expires? Or
I believe that's correct.
Second question.
Brett Marsh.
Can you tell us how these tribal enterprise zones are created?
Chair Hess and Co-Chair Barnhart and I'm losing track of order. Representative Marsh, Co-Chair Hess, Co-Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee. So this is something where the tribe, there's a process the tribe applies to, I commonly call it Business Oregon, but Oregon Business. And they, you know, they make sure that the standards are met. You know, it has to be a limited size, and but there are not a lot of requirements for it. It has to be on reservation or on tribal trust land. It has to be set aside by the tribal council or the governing body. In the case of Umatilla's, it's called the Board of Trustees, but it's a fairly brief process with them because of the high poverty rate and unemployment rates on most reservations.
That was my point, was that I believe it's established by our Board of Trustees, and then we work through our Department of Economic Development, and at this point we've put over $37 million into that interchange of investment by the tribe. And as a result, you know, we've been able to attract the United States Forest Service. Their Northeast Oregon headquarters are now located there. You know, we've just been able to provide the services, and in addition, we've also been able to expand the truck stop and all those things.
And Chairman, if I may follow up for a second, I think back in 2001, there was an understanding by the Legislative Assembly that it was not acceptable that there be places in Oregon where the unemployment rate be as high as it was at Warm Springs. Now it's even higher. And one of the benefits of this, of course, as we have more employment, many of these folks, again, as the federal government steps back, they're relying on the Oregon Health Plan payments. It's a very dire situation for a lot of folks, and they rely heavily on federal, mostly on state programs, and there are of course tribal programs as well. But it is a benefit to, I think, ultimately to state budgets as well to have this employment. I mean, the Umatillas have done an incredible job of turning things around on that reservation. It used to be closer to reversed in terms of unemployment with Warm Springs. So.
Representative Bueller.
Can you outline who's being employed in the enterprise zone in terms of Umatilla tribe members versus others?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Bueller. Off the top of my head, my understanding is two-thirds of our employees are non-tribal and a third tribal. Keep in mind the enrolled membership of Umatilla tribes is about 3,500 people.
And the truck stop interchange is where exactly?
It's the Mission exit. There off of
Warm Springs Highway.
No. Yours should be up on I-84. And so I want to say it's exit 210. I've driven it a few times. And then the truck stop itself was non-tribally owned and then was acquired by the tribes. And a really nice destination now, particularly if you're a trucker.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm inclined to continue this tax credit, but I don't really like the precedent of getting rid of the sunsets altogether. Almost everyone who has a tax credit, when they come, say it we need it to go away so that people will have the assurance that it's always going to be there. We've heard that from many different recipients of tax credits, and this precedent bothers me. And I think that we worked really hard for several years, if you remember, to get to the point where we actually did put sunsets on tax credits so that we could review them, because before we started reviewing them, none of them had sunsets, and we didn't pay any attention to them, and they just continued on forever, whether they were needed or not. And the point of the sunset is to have a periodic review, and everyone who has a sunset wants to get rid of it. So I'm hesitant to do that.
Thank you. Rep. Barnhart.
Thank you. In following up on that comment, if the committee decided not to recommend an outright repeal of the sunset, what would be a reasonable extension? Let me preface that by saying I know that 6 years is a number we picked out of the air when we adopted the idea in 2009. It may not be the right number for many tax credits for exactly the reasons you've stated. What makes more sense if we were to determine to follow Senator Riley's thoughts and keep the tax credit but for a different period of time?
Mr. Co-Chair, could we confer offline before we put a hard number on the record?
I think that's fine, and if it's okay with Chair Hass, to get back to us. If I could finish the thought, you indicate that you have 25-year leases, and you may end up with 50-year leases. It occurs to me that something quite a bit longer than 6 years might make more sense, but not forever. And then we put a note in the file that. That the committee, our successors, if Oregon still exists at that far off period of time, should consider this when it's still 6, 8, 10 years out. I'm making up stuff here, but think about that and get back to us if you would.
I think Central and Eastern Oregon's still going to exist. I hear.
It may be at a lower elevation, however.
Right.
All right, well, appreciate the discussion, and I think to Senator Riley's point, this is exactly the kind of discussion we need on these things. Why they sunset every 6 years is not necessarily to say we want it to go away, or just that it necessitates this kind of discussion, which I think is valuable. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
To close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145, and our final hearing today is on House Bill 2072. Chris, if you want to lead us through there and also discuss the exploding manure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2072 moves the sunset date for the biomass production collection tax credit to January 1, 2024. Under current law, the sunset date is kind of split. Most of the credit is scheduled to sunset January 1, 2018. The manure piece of it is scheduled to sunset on January 1, 2022, and that happened in the 2016 last session. This bill realigns it so that the entire program has one sunset date. So for much of the tax credit, it's a six-year extension. for the manure piece. It's a two-year extension. The other significant policy decision in the bill is that it moves administration of the woody biomass tax credit from the Department of Energy to Forestry, and it also creates an annual cap of $600,000 for the woody biomass tax credit. So that's the bill. In that summary document, there is some other background information just for some context as you discuss the bill. On the third page, there are about 10 different types of material that are eligible for the tax credit, and it ranges from 5 cents a pound to $10 per ton. Most of those types of material don't have a significant most of the revenue impact is driven by a couple pieces of that. Most of that these days is the manure tax credit. And if you scroll down, you can see there's a chart there that is the total cost of the tax credit that it increased for a couple of years. It's been up and down over the years, but for the past couple of years, 2012 to 2014, it's been increasing again. And the part I wanted to point out at the bottom of the next page we have two charts. Most of the tax credit has been taken up by woody biomass and manure. The top chart there is a history of the material that's been eligible for the tax credit, and you can see that since 2013, most of it has been the manure piece. The lower chart there is the revenue impact for the tax credit from 2010 through preliminary information for 2016. This chart represents certification data from the Department of Energy, so it's fairly preliminary, but you can see that for the first couple of years, the woody biomass was the largest player, but it dropped off in 2012. That's when the rate changed to the bone dry ton. And since that time, the manure tax credit has increased. However, even that has declined over the past couple of years. And the other relevant policy part there is that in 2016, when the manure part extended, the tax credit rate was reduced from $5 per ton to $3.50 per ton. So that's just some context.
Per wet ton.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Nobody's getting any humor today on Friday afternoon. Rep Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicate that the bill moves the woody biomass administration to ag. What happens to the manure one?
In this bill, it stays with the Department of Energy. There was another bill, or at least one other bill, for the assembly that moved the manure tax credit to the Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
So the policy has been discussed. I'd have to check on exactly what discussions happened in the policy committee. That particular bill isn't in here, but for the entire credit, there was talk of moving it entirely away from ODO and woody going to forestry and manure going to ag. But then what I'm not certain about is you still have five or six other types of material that would be eligible for a tax credit if they were extended. Of course, the committee has the option of extending any portion of that. You can sunset all of it. You can extend the woody and manure. You can separate those into two distinct tax credits, and you can let everything else sunset. You have a lot of options there.
Thank you.
Okay, let's deal with biomass first. Heath Curtis and Amanda Dalton.
Co-chairs Haas and Barnhart, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here today on behalf of Biomass One, and we're a 30-megawatt woody biomass-fueled power plant down in White City in Jackson County. Here today specifically to offer our support for House Bill 2072A. Some of you have heard this from me before in the House and Senate Energy Committee, so I'll kind of go through some of the policy and talk a little bit about what was done in that committee. As many of you know, woody biomass is one component of the larger biomass category, which includes organic plant and animal materials. Woody biomass specifically is the limbs, treetops, needles, leaves, and other parts of woody trees grown in the forest. The most common source of biomass-based electricity is wood. The most common method of converting biomass to electricity is through direct fire combustion. Oregon has approximately 17 woody biomass power facilities, the majority of which produce both heat and electricity. These cogeneration facilities are often built alongside sawmills and other timber facilities to also utilize the heat they are generating on site. We believe there's an economic benefit to woody biomass, and production of renewable energy and biomass collection provides an economic economic opportunity in rural Oregon by putting to work underutilized material. Biomass One, for example, has 62 direct employees and supports hundreds of indirect jobs through its biomass collection and processing operations. And Interfer, which is located down in Gilcrest and Klamath Falls, supports over 150 local jobs. Current challenges, and really why we're here today asking for an extension of the woody biomass tax credit, is that biomass removal is not without its challenges, stemming largely from location. And generally speaking, forest biomass is the highest cost material that any biomass facility uses. It stems from several reasons, including access challenges on winding and sometimes steep forest roads, the distance of timberlands with clean biomass to the biomass facility. Biomass One, for example, collects in southwest and central Oregon, and our fuel sourcing area has increased by approximately 90 miles just in the last year and a half. In addition, it's labor-intensive work of collecting and grinding woody biomass in often rough terrain. This collection credit helps to offset these high costs, expanding the working circle around where the biomass plant materials can be accessed. In addition, the important tax credit reflects the growing and increasing demand for renewable energy and mirrors our state renewable policy goals by incentivizing the collection of materials, stimulating new economic investment and green job opportunities, increasing forest health, and increasing our energy independence for Oregon by providing clean, homegrown sources of heat and electricity. I'll note that the credit requires the biomass to be sourced within the state of Oregon. We did amend House Bill 2072 to address some of the current budget challenges and competing voices for credits, as well as the comments made during the interim joint Department of Energy reorg committee. And to meet those specific concerns, we did three things in the policy committee. One, as you heard from staff, we separated the woody biomass from the broader biomass credit by moving the administration to the Department of Forestry. We extended the credit to 2024, which is the six-year norm. We also capped the tax credit at $600,000. This is something we heard a lot about from the ODO Joint Reorg Committee during the interim about the need for sideboards on some of these renewable energy tax credits, and we're hoping by putting that cap and committing to continuing this conversation throughout the interim to continue to set sideboards and parameters on these renewable energy credits, we can make this a long-term sustainable credit. We do hope that you include this in your final bill and support an extension today. Thank you.
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. We're testifying in favor of House Bill 2072A. Co-Chair Barnhart, I think, accurately characterized why one would support a tax credit. That is to say, it's typically because you want to incentivize more of something. And so then the question becomes for you, why would you want to incentivize this? And I think Amanda very quickly hit on a number of the relevant points, and I'd echo three of them. One, you know, biomass energy is a renewable, carbon-neutral baseload energy capacity. That's a hard thing to find in renewables. There's geothermal, and there's really biomass. Other than that, you've got largely fluctuating renewable energy sources like solar and wind. This can play an important role in supplementing those. Two, biomass is collected and utilized largely in rural areas. This will contribute to rural employment opportunities. And three, I think this is an important point, is that usually the biomass that we're collecting, the alternative is that it's actually burned on the forest floor as forest slash, or left there to decompose with attendant methane emissions associated with it. So if your choice is between burning slash in the forest or burning it in a very controlled environment in a biomass facility, I would suggest that the latter is the better outcome. And so on those three points, I think that utilizing biomass it's good policy, right? And so then the question for you becomes, is that the kind of thing that you want to incentivize? I think what you see here is a relatively modest program that incentivizes the collection and production of biomass for purposes of biofuels or bioenergy production. We think that that's a good policy for the state of Oregon. It is compatible with our other policy goals, and we would encourage your support.
Thank you, Senator Riley.
Thank you. One of the reasons for tax credits. But the question always arises, but for, and I'm curious what sort of a profit margin the companies that do this operate on?
So, Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, Senator Riley, I don't actually know the answer to that question, but maybe I could characterize it to you in a little bit different way. I think without this tax credit, that is to say, the biomass production and collection tax credit, you would still see biomass used in Oregon for energy. What this tax credit does is it makes collection of that biomass more economical. And so what that results in is that facility where you're processing your biomass can reach farther to collect it and still be profitable. And so the question for you becomes, is that an impact that you think is desirable? I've tried to describe to you some of the positive benefits associated with the activity. I think that profitability, notwithstanding, it does make reaching that next further stick profitable.
So my question is, how far do we go? And is it, you say it makes that next step profitable, which implies that the first step is already profitable. So the question then is, once you make that next step, is it still profitable? And I, that didn't give me the answer.
I may try it one. Senator Haas and Chair Barnhart, Senator Riley, there was some discussion on the House Energy side where a couple of biomass facility producers had come in to testify, and their estimated cost for actual kind of break even on transporting this is $25 per dry ton, and we're at $10. So that kind of gives you an idea where we're at. As fuel costs and transportation costs increase, I can tell you that Biomass One, for example, would begin to narrow that radius, wouldn't be able to go as far to pick up the woody debris. And I think it's important, too, to recognize, similar to your hearing last week on the RETC, biomass is one of those kind of rare renewables that requires an extra step. We can't just build it and let the sun shine and the wind blow. We have to collect and then bring it back to the facility to generate the energy. And so that's where I think, as we look to both investing in our renewable energy goals, biomass is a little bit different than those, which is why this credit, I think, was what we believe it's intended for.
Co-chairs Haas and Barnhart, Senator Riley, I think that it's a difference on the margin. That is to say, this tax credit makes that activity marginally more profitable. And as a result, I think you can expect to see marginally more of that activity as a result. And so the question is that an outcome that you want? We do.
Thank you.
How was the $600,000 cap arrived at?
So Co-Chairs Haas and Barnhart, that number was really taken from the Department of Energy's presentation that they had made to the policy committees on usage. The most recent numbers we had seen in 2015, which I think were as of February 1 of 2017, showed usage of woody biomass at 567,000. And so we capped it at 600,000 in hopes to have a broader renewable energy tax credit discussion over the interim to provide a more accurate account.
Thank you. You indicated originally that the idea was to move this credit to the ag, and instead ended up at forestry. Did I misunderstand that?
Co-chairs Barnhart and Haas, we had always intended for it to go to the Department of Forestry. There may have been a different bill that was taking it to the Department of Ag.
The manure.
Thank you. I believe that's correct. The Department of Forestry testify on the mechanisms that are contained in the bill for their operation of the credit. They're okay with it.
Co-chairs Barnhart and Haas, they did not testify. We have spoken with them. They are administering, I think, the tail of another credit, and so had some experience with it. Though you'll see in the fiscal, they are asking for additional support attached to the administration of the new credit.
And that's, if I could, that's through a fee charge to the person applying for the credit?
That's correct. A portion of the fee would cover the new FTE proposed in that fiscal.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. When you describe woody biomass as carbon neutral, are you looking at a life cycle analysis, or what are you looking at exactly?
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, Senator Marsh, Representative Marsh, so, right, that's a large topic of conversation. I can confidently say that we have a large body of science supporting the notion that utilizing forest biomass is a carbon neutral activity. There are some sectors that may disagree with that, and I would be happy to show you why we believe it is. I didn't come today prepared with those materials, but that is a very large conversation and one we are definitely equipped to have.
Thank you. A lot of these questions, everybody's doing their due diligence here and sound critical, but I don't think there's any disagreement here on the benefits of biomass and
right.
carbon neutrality and cutting down on slash burning. So, all right. Thank you. Jenny Dressler of the Oregon Farm Bureau, your team, Len Bergstein.
Co-chairs Hassan Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. I am also here today speaking with the support of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and Three Mile Canyon Farms. And then Len is here representing Three Mile Canyon Farms if there are any questions in particular about the manure digester tax credit. We support maintaining a working manure digester tax credit that has very clear environmental, renewable energy, and economic benefits. I think it's important to realize that the credit benefits dairies of all sizes in all areas of the state. So not just large, not just small, but we have members of all sizes who utilize that. The manure digesters break down animal waste through an anaerobic process that essentially creates two valuable byproducts for the farmer. Energy is created for on and off farm use by capturing methane, and then the digested fibers can be used for animal bedding. The digester also provides public benefits, including air quality, water quality, and part of the renewable energy portfolio. The program has been very successful in encouraging dairy farmers to invest in these digesters, and since it began, we have 8 in different locations across the state. And they end up processing waste from about 35% of dairy cows in Oregon. Today, we are here to support a smart adjustment to that program. So there was a little bit of discussion about where these credits should be housed. Our coalition agrees that the program should be moved to the Department of Agriculture. We believe that they are well positioned to accept the administration of this program. And I believe, and I have not been in the inner circle here, but I believe that there have been discussions with the stakeholders around a permit certification fee in order to help fund that transition and the administration of it. We also want to reiterate our support for the balance that came out of the 2016 session that extended that sunset to 2022. So not 2024, and we're not asking for 2024, but that 2022 extension, and then reduce the incentive rate from $5 per wet ton to $3.50. Third, while we don't think that there's going to be a huge rush for these programs in the near term, we have had discussions internally within the group and would consider supporting or would support a $10 million per biennium cap on the program. There have been conversations over the past couple of years about exposure that the state feels with this program, and we don't believe that you're going to see a significant increase in the program currently or the utilization of the program given the price of milk. You see a drop-off, or you saw a drop-off in that one chart around the usage of this credit, and I believe when you look at the economics of the dairy industry right now, things are not trending upwards. So I know that a lot of the families and a lot of the companies are struggling with the place that the milk prices are at, but we did have internal discussions, and should the state feel exposure, I know that the group has come to an agreement to support a $10 million per biennium cap. So I appreciate the opportunity to come before you, and I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Any questions? We've talked manure a lot, so happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I've got several, and maybe this one is for Three Mile Canyon. I take it that you agree with the testimony we just heard about the various ways in which the bill might be changed.
Yes, Chair, we do.
Thank you. And the bill, as it's written, contains several provisions about what the Department of Energy will do in terms of administration of the credit, and then other provisions that talk about the woody biomass portion of what the State Forestry Department will do. Is it your understanding, and this is for both of you, that that the statutory rules established here would work for if we were to move this to the Department of Agriculture instead. The rules set forth are contain a number of powers in the department for rulemaking, fee charging, and things of that sort, and also providing lists to the Department of Revenue. All of these things would work with the proposals you've made, wouldn't they, even if they were being run by the Department of Agriculture instead of by the Department of Energy?
Chair Barnard, yes, we agree with that. We like the idea of it being in the Department of Agriculture. We'd like them to have rule-making authority on this. We accede to the notion that a reasonable permit fee for certification is appropriate. We would be supportive of that 100%. Clearly, there's a difference between the two industries. Woody right. Biomass is a different subject matter, and we were a part with them of a bill, and as you know, of an earlier session, and then the legislature, in its wisdom, decided to split those apart and kind of deal with the industries separately because the industrial basis of the tax credit and the productivity of the product were different. But we do believe the essential answer to your question is yes. We like the direction it's going to the Department of Agriculture, and we would be supportive of all of the rulemaking.
Well, you can, if I could, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking the question is because we're faced with having to act fairly quickly and having a model already available here. Changing the word from energy to agriculture makes life a lot simpler for us if it works.
Yes, Chair, it does. The Department of Agriculture has experience, as you know, with food processing tax credits, and so they are familiar with this also, so you can have confidence that they know how to do this kind of program and will be able to step right up. The Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture have already been in discussions to make sure that the DOE expertise is available to the Department of Ag to kind of get them up and going immediately.
Thank you. So that's already been done.
They've begun discussions of it, not to be presumptuous about what the legislature would do, but they've already anticipated that you want to make sure that there's not an orphan program, that it in fact gets moved, and if it gets moved, that the administration, the agencies will work together to make sure that those work in concert. Yeah.
Thank you.
Senator
Mr. Chair.
So this is for Chris. Isn't this the one that we talked about? There's a separate bill to move it to the Department of Agriculture. Is that...
There is a separate bill that moved the manure piece to the Department of Agriculture.
And isn't that
that's what we're talking about?
Right. The bill before you doesn't do that.
But if they both pass, they would be.
That would be your discretion.
We have to add that language.
We would have to add that language in this.
Yes.
They wouldn't be combined if they both pass.
Well, they'd all be combined into House Bill 2066
okay.
eventually, but. Yeah.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, I think that bill was in the House Ag Committee, and I think that it failed the deadline.
Right.
Okay. That answered my question. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, if we decide to do that, I'm just saying that's how it would.
If I may, Chairs, it's my understanding that the Tax Credit Committee is looking at this question of taking to making the kinds of administrative decisions that you're talking about.
Yes.
Questions. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee. We're at the end of our agenda. It's been a long week down here. Just so everyone knows, a joint committee will meet on Tuesday at 8:30 for a public hearing on the bill before that committee, and again at 5 p.m. for a public hearing on that bill. Oh. So two public hearings in joint committee.
I
forgive me. We're still in public hearing, and I went out of order here, and I have Ivan from Friend of Family Farms signed up to testify. So sorry, I'm
catch out of order. We're anxious.
Yes.
Chairs Hostin, Barnard, members of the committee, out of respect for your time, I'll try to go quickly. For the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. I wanted to testify today because we have some concerns about the manure digester tax credit specifically, we've submitted longer written testimony. I hope you'll take a chance to review because they outlined some of our concerns around the lack of transparency and verifiability that currently exists here, the the fact that Oregon doesn't really have a larger program around air quality that this is part of, that we believe it should be part of, and that we do believe it's primarily benefiting larger confinement operations as opposed to that family small and mid-sized farm that's got animals on pasture. So I won't read the testimony, but I want to highlight a few points. And I also want to clarify that we have no position on the woody component of this. We're just strictly talking about the manure piece. Our organization represents small and mid-sized farmers around the state, and we have some concerns around this. Obviously, I had not been aware of some of the conversations that the previous two panelists had talked about. So one element that I was hoping to highlight is that the extension to 2024 is a very substantial concern to us in particular. So we disagreed with the extension to 2022. We actually believe this credit should be allowed to sunset at its originally intended date at the end of this year. But we would certainly support not extending it to 2024. That's where, if you look at the fiscal impact statement, a lot of the additional cost to the state is in that extra 2 years. Because as you've seen, the manure component of the biomass tax credit generally has grown substantially over time. It reduced a little bit, I think, because in 2016 because the per ton rate was reduced from $5 to wet ton to $3.50, but not necessarily because you saw less use. In terms of switching it to agencies, it's definitely clear that the Oregon Department of Energy does not currently track the outcomes in a way that's transparent and accountable. This is mentioned in the fiscal impact statement as well. But in terms of moving it to another agency, I guess I'll flag we have concerns about moving it to the Department of Agriculture. We think the Oregon DEQ would be a more appropriate agency. Number one, the DEQ actually already has to issue a Title V permit under the Clean Air Act for a number of these types of facilities in general. And so they're already a permitting agency when it comes to this, whereas the ODA does not have any sort of air quality or oversight. So the ODA is not normally in the process of any regulatory involvement in these actual digesters, except unless it relates to manure management from a water quality perspective, not an air quality perspective. Second, I just want to flag a potential conflict of interest here in that the largest recipient of this tax credit currently sits on the board of the Oregon Board of Agriculture, or the Oregon Board of Agriculture, which provides oversight and advice to the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I think that's a concern to us. I don't think it looks good for the state of Oregon to be having the department, you know, have its largest tax credit recipient be sitting on its own board. So we would again urge you to seriously consider the DEQ as being perhaps a better agency to have oversight here. We think that we're not sure that even switching agencies, unless we provide some additional sideboards, just switching the agency isn't going to address some of these issues. We're not tracking independently, you know, how this is benefiting the taxpayers on a number of different levels. In terms of methane, we know that a lot of methane doesn't come out the back end of the cows, it comes out the front end. And we're doing nothing through these digesters to mitigate that. And in addition, by this tax credit really favors sort of a confinement model where you've got to have a large number of animals indoors in order to provide a steady supply of manure. So in that way, it really kind of picks winners and losers. It says if you've got a large confinement operation and you want to create a digester, we've got a tax credit for you. But if you want to run your animals on pasture and sequester carbon in the soils through perennial good responsible grazing management, we don't have anything for you. And the reason why that's important is because we think that's a potentially a very good way for livestock producers to be honored for their contributions to mitigating climate change. And we think that this tax credit, unfortunately, puts all of the incentive on one side of the ledger and doesn't look at the broader perspective. My segue here is that 10 years ago, we were part of a task force along with Three Mile Canyon Farms and others to propose an Oregon Dairy Air Emissions Program, which talked about both voluntary and regulatory approaches. We were supposed to be regulating some of these operations by now, and we're not. And ultimately, we talked about tax credits there, but we talked about them for a variety of best management practices. We never talked about them as solely being for digesters. And so there was a bill earlier this session, Senate Bill 197. It fell to the wayside. That would have finally created that long overdue consensus air emissions program for dairies in the state. Our belief is that part of why we would support sunsetting this tax credit now is that we think that the tax credit should be part of a larger conversation around air emissions that consensus proposal we came up with, and looking at a variety of ways to mitigate climate change through manure and pasture management. So just not focusing solely on the digesters. And so our concern is that we're not really looking at those other pieces as it's currently constructed. So I'll just conclude here by saying that that we've got a few key recommendations. One, again, we need to establish this Oregon Dairy Air Emissions Program before we move forward with the tax credit. We think it's got to be part of a larger conversation, not just a standalone piece where we're not really measuring its impact independently. Second, instead of offering these tax credits to the larger operations, we should really make that a cost of doing business for the very largest operations in the state. So it's been in the news a lot recently, but we've got a new 30,000 cow dairy operations that's recently been permitted in the state of Oregon, or it's permitted for up to 30,000 cows. An operation that size, frankly, should be required to have this technology on premises as a condition of doing business in our state. We shouldn't be offering them a tax incentive to then mitigate after the fact. So that way, that would free up more money for the small and mid-sized operations where this really doesn't pencil out as well. And also for not only encouraging digesters on smaller operations, but also some of these other practices I talked about, encouraging rotational grazing, perennial pasture management, the types of things that actually sequester carbon for the long term in soils. So looking at a size threshold, I think, is very important here. I'll just transition here and just say, if we're going to look at a cap, I think a cap is a very good idea. We would argue it should be closer to 5 million per biennium. That would be very similar to how it's actually being used right now. And so 10 million, that's frankly, you're allowing it to double in size, more or less, if we set a $10 million per biennium cap. So we would suggest something closer to 5 million, if that's ultimately the intent. So, and then lastly, I think, you know, this is essentially we're paying for operating costs the way it's currently constructed. So if the sunset, if we in the future continue to extend the sunset, we may find ourselves essentially paying for these digesters long after they've already been constructed, the costs of constructing them have been paid for. So having some sort of per facility cap may also be an appropriate thing to look at, so that we're only paying for some percentage of their construction as opposed to indefinite operation. And then lastly, looking at something regionally, I think there's some unique regional issues. I think Tillamook County in particular is somewhere where this technology can really have co-benefits around protecting water quality and air quality. Other parts of the state, if we're looking at scarce state dollars, perhaps we should look at some regional targets. So helping out farmers in Tillamook County as opposed to necessarily making it available statewide, particularly to the largest operations as we're getting more of those coming in. So thanks very much for your time. I sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you. Any questions, Ivan? All right, sir, thank you. And I apologize again for skipping.
Not a problem.
Long day, long week. Okay, we will close a public hearing on House Bill 2072 after this comment from...
No, it's a different
close
comment.
Public hearing. Rep. Barnhart?
I just want to remind House members that we have a bunch of stuff to do at 1 o'clock on Monday. That will be our next House Revenue Committee meeting. And I will, of course, encourage everyone to be here Tuesday morning at 8:30.
Okay, we are adjourned.